A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
My Weird Prompts is a community-driven initiative exploring how AI can fuel curiosity and uncover the fascinating ways our world works. GPU compute for this podcast is generously provided by Modal. Learn more at modal.com.
I was looking at the telemetry data coming out of the Gulf yesterday, and it is chilling to see that giant hole in our coverage where the Qatar radar used to be. It is March 14th, 2026, and it feels like we're flying blind in the middle of a hurricane. It is like trying to watch a high-speed car chase through a keyhole while someone keeps flicking the lights on and off.
It is a massive strategic blind spot, Herman Poppleberry here, and you are right to be concerned, Korn. When that ANFPS 132 early warning radar at Al Udeid went dark on February 28th, we lost a critical layer of verification that separates a bad day from an existential one. Today's prompt from Daniel is about this very crisis, specifically the pre-launch ambiguity we are facing in the current Iran-Israel conflict. He wants us to look at the technical challenges of identifying a nuclear-armed ballistic missile in those final, terrifying minutes before a launch.
It is a sobering thought because we have literally never been here before. People think about Hiroshima or Nagasaki, but those were gravity bombs dropped from planes. The flight time was measured in hours, and the visibility was clear. We are talking about a scenario where the entire cycle, from the moment a missile leaves a tunnel to the moment it hits a city in Israel, is measured in minutes. Daniel is asking how we distinguish between a conventional high-explosive warhead and a nuclear physics package when they look identical on the outside of a mobile launcher.
That is the core of the problem, and it is what researchers like James Acton have been warning about for years. He calls it pre-launch ambiguity. In a regional conflict like this one in March 2026, the timeline is so compressed that the luxury of certainty has basically vanished. Iran has roughly 3,000 ballistic missiles, and since they ended the JCPOA back in October of 2025, the question of what is inside those nose cones is no longer academic. We are moving from the theoretical breakout phase, which we covered in episode 722, into the final 3 minutes phase.
Right, and with the destruction of those THAAD radar arrays in Jordan and the UAE earlier this month, we are leaning almost entirely on space-based assets. I want to dig into the physics of that, because I think people have a bit of a Hollywood idea of what satellites can actually see. We are not getting a high-definition video of a technician bolting a warhead on, are we?
Not even close. The primary tool we have is the Space-Based Infrared System, or SBIRs. These are satellites in both geostationary and highly elliptical orbits that are tuned to pick up intense heat signatures. They are looking for the massive infrared plume of a rocket motor. The problem is that SBIRs has a refresh rate of about 10 seconds. In the world of ballistic missiles, 10 seconds is an eternity. By the time you get your third or fourth data point to confirm a trajectory, the missile is already well into its boost phase.
And even then, the heat signature of a rocket motor is the same, whether the warhead is filled with TNT or a 20 kiloton nuclear device. The rocket does not care about the payload's chemistry, only its mass. So, if we are looking at a Shahab, 3 or one of the newer Fatah missiles, can we actually detect a mass difference through satellite telemetry?
It is theoretically possible, but practically a nightmare. A nuclear warhead is generally heavier and more compact than a conventional one of the same size, which affects the acceleration curve and the fuel consumption rate. But you would need incredibly high fidelity tracking to notice that the missile is accelerating 0.5% slower than a standard conventional model. With the ground-based radars in Qatar and Jordan destroyed, we have lost the ability to get those high-resolution Doppler shifts that could tell us the exact velocity. We are left with the infrared blobs from SBIRs, which tell us something is flying, but not necessarily what is inside the tip.
It feels like Iran's strategy of blinding our radar network was a very deliberate precursor to this exact moment. If you take out the ground-based eyes, you force the US and Israel to make a decision based on the lowest common denominator of intelligence. You create a situation where every launch has to be treated as a potential nuclear strike, because you can't prove it isn't.
That is a classic move from the escalation playbook. By degrading our sensor diversity, they are trying to shorten our decision window to the point where human oversight becomes a liability. If you only have 3 to 5 minutes of flight time from a launch site in western Iran to a target in Tel Aviv, and your sensors are fuzzy, the pressure to launch a preemptive strike or an immediate counterstrike is immense. We are talking about the ultimate stress test of the command and control structure.
Let's break down that blinding strategy a bit more. When the Al Udeid radar was hit on February 28th, what exactly did we lose in terms of data? I mean, we still have satellites, so why does a ground radar matter so much?
Ground-based radars like the ANFPS-132 provide what we call high-fidelity tracking. While a satellite sees the heat, the radar sees the physical object. It can track the missile's skin, not just the fire coming out of the back. This allows for much more precise calculations of the ballistic coefficient. If you know exactly how much drag the missile is experiencing, and exactly how fast it is accelerating, you can start to make educated guesses about the weight of the warhead. Without that radar, you are trying to guess the weight of a car by looking at the brightness of its headlights from 5 miles away. It is a massive degradation of data quality.
And then on March 5th, we had the reports of the THAAD radars in Jordan and the UAE being hit. Those are even more specialized, right?
THAAD radars, the ANATPY-2, are X-band radars. They are designed for terminal phase tracking, meaning they are incredibly good at distinguishing between a warhead and a piece of debris or a decoy. By taking those out, Iran isn't just making it harder to see the launch. They are making it harder to intercept the missile if it is launched. They are stripping away the layers of the onion until all we have left is the core, which is a very binary, very scary decision-making process.
I have heard people talk about radiation signatures. Is there any reality to the idea that we have sensors that can sniff out the gamma rays or neutrons from a nuclear warhead while it is sitting on a launcher?
That is mostly a myth in the context of rapid response ballistic missiles. While we do have specialized sensors for detecting radiation, they generally require close proximity. You might use them at a border crossing or a port. Trying to detect the radiation leakage from a shielded warhead inside a reinforced nose cone, on a mobile launcher, from a satellite or a high-altitude drone is nearly impossible. The atmospheric shielding alone would block most of the signal. Unless the Iranians are incredibly sloppy with their handling protocols, we are not going to see a glow on our sensors.
So if the physics of the missile and the radiation signatures don't give us the answer, we have to look at the behavioral indicators. What are the ISR? The intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. Markers that would trigger a nuclear classification. I assume the way you move a nuclear weapon is different from how you move a standard crate of missiles.
This is where the human and technical intelligence has to merge. You are looking for things like specialized security details, the presence of specific communication vehicles that only accompany nuclear-capable units, or even the activity levels at known hardened storage sites. In May of 2025, the Defense Intelligence Agency estimated that Iran could have enough fissile material for a weapon in less than a week. If we see the IRGC moving specialized canisters from a site like Natanz or Fordow toward a mobile launcher base, that is a huge red flag.
But even that is ambiguous because of the mobile launchers, the TELs. We have talked about the nuclear truck in previous episodes, like episode 697. These things are designed to hide in tunnels and pop out just long enough to fire. If they are practicing good operational security, they could move a conventional missile and a nuclear one in identical convoys.
They absolutely could. And that is the nightmare scenario for an intelligence analyst. You are looking at two identical trucks coming out of a tunnel in the Zagros Mountains. One has a conventional warhead meant to hit a military base. The other has a 20-kiloton nuclear device meant for a city. From a satellite's perspective, they look exactly the same. They move at the same speed, they have the same escort, and they use the same radio frequencies. This is the "is it a nuke?" problem in its purest form.
And this brings us to the terrifying dilemma of launch on warning versus launch under attack. If the Israeli or U.S. command sees a salvo of missiles coming out of western Iran, and they know the radar is blinded, do they wait for the first impact to see if it is a mushroom cloud?
That is the question that keeps national security advisors awake at night. If they wait, and it is a nuke, their own ability to retaliate might be decapitated. Israel is a small country. A single well-placed nuclear strike could effectively end their ability to function as a state. But if they fire back immediately with everything they have, and it turns out it was just a conventional volley, they have just started a nuclear war that didn't need to happen. The launch-on-warning doctrine is designed to ensure deterrence, but it relies on the warning being accurate. When the sensors are compromised, the doctrine becomes a suicide pact.
It is a game of chicken played at Mach 5, and with the current political climate, especially after the major combat operations started in late February, the trust level is at absolute zero. The US and Israel have made it clear that a nuclear Iran is a red line. When you have a red line that is being tested in a fog of war, the margin for error disappears.
It really does. Let's look at the hypothetical timeline. From the moment the engine ignites on a medium-range ballistic missile in Iran to the moment of impact in Tel Aviv is often less than 10 minutes. Let's walk through those 600 seconds.
Okay, walk me through it. T minus zero, the missile ignites.
At T plus 10 seconds, SBIRs picks up the infrared plume. The data is beamed to a relay station and then to the North American Aerospace Defense Command and the Israeli Defense Forces. That takes maybe 30 seconds. Now you are at T plus 40 seconds. The analysts see a launch. They have to determine the trajectory. Is it heading for a desert or a city? That takes another 60 seconds. Now you are at T plus 100 seconds. You have 8 minutes left.
And this is where the missing radar hurts us.
Usually, at this point, the Al Udeid radar would be providing a high-resolution track. It would tell us the exact velocity and acceleration. Without it, we are still looking at a fuzzy heat signature. The analysts have to decide, is this a standard Shahab 3, or is it something heavier? They look at the launch site. Is it near a known nuclear storage facility? They check the SIGINT signal's intelligence. Are the Iranians using nuclear-only codes? This takes another 2 minutes. Now you are at T plus 220 seconds. You have about 6 minutes left.
6 minutes to decide the fate of millions of people.
And you have to get the Prime Minister or the President on the line. You have to brief them on the ambiguity. You have to tell them, we see a launch, it's heading for Tel Aviv, we think it might be nuclear, but we can't be sure because our radars are down. That conversation takes 2 minutes. Now you are at T plus 340 seconds. You have 4 minutes left.
4 minutes. I spend more time than that deciding what to have for breakfast. The idea that a leader has to make a binary choice on nuclear escalation in that window, while receiving conflicting reports because their primary radars are smoking ruins, is just wild.
It is the most dangerous scenario since the Cuban Missile Crisis, but with much faster technology. Back in the 60s, we had hours to talk. Today, we have seconds, and Iran knows this. Their targeting of the ANFPS 132 radar in Qatar wasn't just a tactical strike to help their conventional missiles get through, it was a strategic strike to degrade our confidence. If you can't trust your sensors, you are more likely to make a mistake, and in nuclear doctrine, a mistake is often terminal.
Let's talk about the "Is it a nuke?" framework from James Acton again. He argues that this ambiguity actually encourages a use-it-or-lose-it mentality. If Iran thinks we might preemptively strike their nuclear assets because we can't tell them apart from their conventional ones, they are more likely to fire them early. It is a feedback loop of instability.
He is spot on. If both sides feel that their survivability depends on acting first due to a lack of clear information, the entire concept of deterrence starts to crumble. Deterrence relies on a certain level of transparency. You have to know what the other guy has and what he is doing so you can respond proportionally. When you take away the sensors, proportionality goes out the window. You end up with a worst-case scenario, decision-making process where you assume the highest level of threat because the cost of being wrong is total destruction.
I wonder about the role of automation here. As these windows shrink to under 180 seconds, there is a massive push to take the human out of the loop. We have talked about AI and defense before, but this seems like the ultimate nightmare for an automated system. You have an AI looking at a fuzzy infrared blob and trying to decide if it represents a threat to millions of lives.
That is a path we have to be incredibly careful with. While an AI can process sensor data faster than a human, it lacks the strategic context. It doesn't know about the diplomatic back channels or the subtle political signals that might suggest a launch is a limited conventional response rather than a total nuclear strike. But when the decision time is less than 3 minutes, the temptation to let the machine decide is huge. If the machine can intercept the missile in the boost phase, but only if it fires within 30 seconds, do you wait for the Prime Minister to wake up?
Probably not. And that brings us back to the importance of sensor diversity. This is why having satellites, ground-based radar, high-altitude drones, and even human intelligence on the ground is so vital. When you lose one, like we lost the Qatar radar, the whole system becomes brittle. You lose the cross-check that prevents a false alarm from turning into a catastrophe.
And we should mention the status of Iran's program as of mid-2025. They had over 400 kilograms of uranium enriched to 60%. That is a massive jump from where they were even a year prior. The IAEA basically said they had enough material for 9 weapons if they just pushed it that last little bit to 90%. The breakout. Time is now measured in days, not months. The gap between we have the fuel and we have the warhead has narrowed significantly.
That is the part that people often miss. They think breakout means the war is over, but the breakout is just the start of this 3-minute window problem. Once they had the material and the capability to mate it to a missile, we are in this permanent state of pre-launch ambiguity. Every time a truck moves in western Iran, the world holds its breath.
It is a state of constant high-tension friction. And it is not just about the missiles themselves. It is about the entire infrastructure of nuclear command and control. If Iran has successfully degraded our ability to see their launches, they have also degraded our ability to signal our own intentions. If we can't see what they are doing, we can't tell them that we know what they are doing, which is a key part of de-escalation.
It is like two people in a dark room with loaded guns. If one person starts moving, the other person has to decide whether to shoot based on the sound of a footstep. You can't see the gun. You can't see the aim. You just hear the movement. That is what the loss of the regional radar network has done to the Middle East in 2026. It has turned the lights off in the room.
That is a perfect analogy. And it is why the current U.S. and Israeli operations are so focused on those missile sites. They are trying to take the guns out of the hands of the person in the dark room before a shot is fired. But every strike on a missile silo or a storage depot carries the risk that the person will panic and fire whatever they have left.
We should look at some of the practical takeaways here. Because this isn't just a scary story, there are real-world implications for how we design these systems going forward. First and foremost is the redundancy of sensors. You cannot rely on a single massive radar installation like Al-Udeid if it is going to be a prime target in the first hour of a war.
We need a more distributed network of smaller, more mobile radar units that are harder to target. We also need to improve the refresh rate of our satellite constellations. If SBIRs could give us a high-fidelity image every second instead of every 10 seconds, we might actually be able to distinguish payload mass through acceleration curves. The technology is getting there, but we are currently caught in a gap between the old way of doing things and the new reality of high-speed conflict.
Another takeaway is the danger of blind spots in our diplomatic and intelligence channels. If we don't have a way to verify what is happening on the ground, we are forced into a defensive crouch that makes escalation more likely. This is why the IAEA monitoring was so important, even if it was flawed. Once that was gone in late 2025, we lost our last eyes inside the house.
And we have to address the misconception that we can just see a nuke from space. I think a lot of people feel a false sense of security because they think the U.S. military has some magic camera that can see through nose cones. We don't. We have very sophisticated sensors, but they are still bound by the laws of physics. Ambiguity is a feature of modern warfare, not a bug that we can just patch out with better software.
It really highlights why the 2025 conflict was such a turning point. Iran learned that their mobile missile force is their best survival tool, and we learned that our early warning network is more vulnerable than we thought. The result is this incredibly fragile standoff we are in right now in March of 2026.
It is a sobering reality. If you want to dive deeper into how Iran reached this nuclear threshold, I highly recommend checking out episode 722, where we broke down the 7-day sprint and the technical side of their breakout capability. We also covered the mobility of these missile units in episode 697, which is essential context for understanding why they are so hard to track.
This really is the ultimate stress test. We are watching the first real-world test of nuclear deterrence in a regional, non-ICBM context where the flight times are shorter than the decision-making protocols. It is a world where the warning is only 3 minutes long, and the cost of a mistake is everything.
It makes you realize how much we have relied on the luxury of time in the past. During the Cold War, an ICBM from the Soviet Union to the U.S. took about 30 minutes. That felt fast then, but compared to 3 minutes, it was an eternity. You could have a full cabinet meeting in 30 minutes. You can't even get a phone call through the switchboard in 3 minutes.
It is a terrifying compression of history. We are essentially betting the future of the region on the hope that both sides can maintain their cool while operating in a state of near-total blindness. And as we have seen over the last few weeks, cool is in very short supply right now.
The final thought I have on this is that we are witnessing a fundamental shift in how wars are deterred. Deterrence used to be about the certainty of retaliation. Now, it is becoming about the uncertainty of the initial strike. If you can't tell what is coming at you, your retaliation is no longer a deterrent. It is a desperate gamble. That is a much less stable foundation for global peace.
It really is. And I think Daniel's prompt hits on the most critical question of our time. Can diplomacy survive when the warning time is shorter than a conversation? If you only have 3 minutes, there is no time for, wait, let's talk. There is only time for fire.
That is the challenge of our age. We have built weapons that move faster than our ability to think. And in March of 2026, we are seeing the consequences of that gap play out in real time.
It is a heavy topic, but one we can't afford to ignore. We will be keeping a very close eye on the telemetry coming out of the region, or whatever is left of it. Thanks as always to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running while we dive into these rabbit holes.
And a big thanks to Modal for providing the GPU credits that power the research and generation behind this show. They make this kind of deep dive possible. This has been My Weird Prompts.
If you want to stay updated on new episodes, search for My Weird Prompts on Telegram to get notified the second they drop. It is the best way to make sure you don't miss anything.
Stay curious and stay informed. We will see you next time.
Take care.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird.